is WHFR, Dearborn.
WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking are teaming up once again in order to bring you our fifth annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Henry Ford Community College Student and Culinary Arts Center. As usual, we are thrilled and excited to bring you this premier holistic event. This year's festival promises to be bigger and better than ever. If you would like to join us as a vendor, reader, or body healer, please call 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, that's call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. We hope you are able to join us at this fantastic festival.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and I have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without big brothers, big sisters. I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything. At a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil. And Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
Big Band. Broadway. And beyond. Hello, I'm Joe, host of Big Band Broadway and Beyond, every Friday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Each week we play the best of American band music, past and present. Included in this is the score of a Broadway musical. Join us every Friday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. for Big Band Broadway and Beyond on the station making waves.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
And we really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is really very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click on the Donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and
thank you for thinking.
Thank you.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, is it all just relative?
Well, clearly some things are just relative. Tastes in food or matters of etiquette, for example.
Right. If you like single malt scotch and I don't, there's no basis for saying that one of us is right and the other is wrong about how good it tastes. Taste is just relative to our individual taste buds.
There's no universal truth, even about single malt scotch. The same goes for etiquette, except that etiquette is relative to cultures or subcultures rather than to individual people and their taste buds. I'm told that in some societies, a gentle burp after a meal is a polite way of expressing satisfaction, but not in ours. But there's really no basis for saying that one culture has it right about burps and the other one has it wrong.
And our question today is everything like etiquette and matters of taste relative? That is, are truth, knowledge, and morality also relative?
I think that question's easy. The answer is no. Some things are obviously not relative. There are some universal or absolute truths. Believing something to be true does not make it true.
Well, what about morality, though?
Well, there are two. I mean, take Hitler, please. Hitler was a really bad man. That's a fact. He and his Nazi followers might have thought it was morally good to slaughter the Jews. Maybe they sincerely thought that. But their thinking that it was so did not make it so.
I don't think it's so obvious to most people that truth and morality are absolute or universal rather than relative, the way you say. Scratch any 17-year-old college freshman, for example, and you know what you're going to get out. You're going to get out reflex relativism. They tend to think that each of us has his own moral code and that nobody is really entitled to question anybody else's moral code.
Well, I think they feel they ought to be tolerant, and they confuse tolerance with relativism. You ought to have respect for other people's opinions, at least till you're sure they're really nutcases. But that doesn't mean you're a relativist. Now, these teenagers may talk like relativists, but when push comes to shove, they won't act like relativists.
Now, Pope Benedict, for one, disagrees with you about this. He sees relativism everywhere. He decries it as the main enemy of the church. He laments that Western civilization is being destroyed by, quote, the dictatorship of relativism.
But look, take something real like female genital mutilation, or the criminalization of homosexuality and really bad treatment of homosexuals in certain African countries. Now, when we're faced with that, you or I or the teenager, if we're a relativist, we have to say, oh, well, we think that's wrong, so it's wrong relative to us, but it's not wrong relative to that. But that's not what we say. What we supposedly relativistic secular Westerners really do is we say, that's wrong, it ought to stop. We don't shrug our shoulders with indifference and say, well, that's how they do things over there.
No, you're right. Most of us feel moral outrage, real moral outrage at such things.
Precisely.
But how does that show that we aren't really relativists? I mean, look, most arguments for relativism begin by observing that some cultures endorse things like female genital mutilation, while other cultures prohibit such things.
Well, that's a beginning point, but the argument can't end there. The relativist has to show not only that there are these different moral outlooks, but that in some way they're all equally valid, like taste or etiquette, and that disputes among them can't be really rationally adjudicated.
No, so I see where you're going with this. You think that the very fact that we express moral outrage over things like female genital mutilation in other cultures shows that we don't really regard all moral systems as equally valid as relativism seems to require.
Right. We regard some systems as superior to others, as closer to the real universal moral truth of the matter.
But why isn't that just a form of intolerant arrogance or cultural imperialism on our part?
Oh, Ken, you're talking like a true would-be relativist and missing my point.
But, well, what is your point?
The differences in moral systems are not like the differences in taste or rules of etiquette. In case of taste and etiquette, we say, to each his own, live and let live. But when it comes to significant moral issues, we think there's a right and wrong in the matter. Torturing innocent children is wrong for any culture. The same with female genital mutilation. Now, we may or may not be certain where the truth lies in a particular case. But then we try to engage in further argument and investigation to find out the truth.
So you're saying that the bare fact that we greet moral disagreement with arguments rather than automatic acceptance or indifference shows that we aren't really relativists.
That is my view exactly.
But look, I want to try a thought experiment on you. Why can't a relativist just have a preference, a pure preference, that others share his or her moral outlook? And a preference like that, wouldn't that itself give the relativist a reason to invite further argument in the face of these differences and disagreements? And couldn't he or she have such a preference, even if he thought that there was no absolute truth in the matter? I just prefer it if we all disagree.
Well, as always, Ken, you've raised a good question. Let's put it to our guest, along with some other questions. He is Paul Boghossian, author of Fear of Knowledge, Against Relativism and Constructivism. Paul will join us in just a little bit.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, talks to a defender of relativism. She files this report.
It is extremely common to hail anthropologists to defend relativism.
Charles Briggs is an anthropologist at UC Berkeley. He spent a lot of time with indigenous communities in South America, and he specializes in folklore. I asked him to talk about relativism from an anthropological point of view.
I remember in graduate school sitting in a bar at the next to the University of Chicago having a raging debate with a philosophy student who was defending universalism against the charge of relativism.
Briggs doesn't see himself as a straight-up relativist, but he criticizes the idea that
anybody who sees the world in different ways somehow got it wrong, and we must convince them, whether it might be through argumentation, education, or war, that they're simply wrong.
Briggs is trained in biomedical anthropology, so when his friends in an indigenous community in eastern Venezuela said they wanted to train him to become a shaman, he resisted.
I had to memorize 300 stories, hundreds of songs. I had to learn how to touch people's bodies and feel within them what I was taught to look for as spirits. I was always a non-smoker, and I had to smoke cigars that were often half an inch or more wide and two-thirds of a meter long, to where I almost couldn't crawl back to my hammock at night. I was so intoxicated.
As a shaman, Briggs said he had to suspend his disbelief, but in the end, he became a pretty successful healer.
And what was remarkable was that in spite of my skepticism, in spite of my resistance, I learned I had dreams in which I would see people who lived around me and would intervene in the middle of my dream in the morning, remarkably find out that they had been extremely ill the night before and that somehow in the course of the night, powerful symptoms somehow had been relieved.
Briggs can't explain why this kind of healing seemed to work, but he knows it doesn't always. Take the cholera outbreak in eastern Venezuela.
It was 1994. An infectious bacterial disease, cholera, had killed, at that point, something like 500 people. This is an easily prevented and treatable disease that should kill no one at this day and age.
The Venezuelan health authorities blamed the indigenous people for spreading the disease.
The indigenous people, known as Warao, believed more in spirits than in germs. They trusted more their own healers than they trusted people within the clinics.
The cholera epidemic illustrates the clash between modern medicine and indigenous ways of healing.
We needed a dialogue between clinical medicine and epidemiology, as well as an understanding of how it is within the indigenous healing system and working with a healer there to understand how people conceive of illness.
This idea of judging one culture by the values or ideas of another happens all the time. For example, Briggs interviewed women charged with infanticide, one of the worst crimes in Venezuelan culture.
One woman was particularly compelling. She said, "I was raped. I hid the pregnancy because I was afraid of what my family and others would say. I was terrified. I gave birth on the 10th floor of an apartment building, and I opened the window, and I threw out my newborn baby."
The woman here was clearly wrong. She should not have killed her baby. But Briggs doesn't quite look at it that way.
Either the violence that had been done to that young woman on the edge of the rainforest, or that this woman said she herself had done to her baby, will never be explicable. But how might we collaborate in being able to understand different points of view that would not condone acts that might be hard to justify in moral terms, but that would enable us to live together in society in more just sorts of ways.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Paul Boghossian. He's professor of philosophy at New York University. He's author of the very fine book, Fear of Knowledge, Against Relativism and Constructivism. Paul, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, Ken. Hello, John. Good to be with you.
Hello, Paul. Let's start this way. Tell us a little bit about what drove you to write a book about relativism.
Well, relativism, I think, is a very powerful idea that has become very influential, I think, both within the academy and therefore inevitably outside of it, because we train people and then they go outside. And it seemed to me that this is an idea that was having such a strong impact in the way people think that it deserved to be studied clearly and closely and to see what aspects of it could be defended and what aspects of it could not.
Well, as you emphasize, in certain circles of academia, relativism, not just about morals but even about truth, is all the rage. Freshmen tend to think that way, and the Pope is really worried about it. How did relativism get to be so fashionable and so feared?
You know, I think the answer to that is very, very complicated and understudied. I think we can isolate or identify certain elements in the narrative that led to its being so powerful. I think part of the story is a kind of understandable reaction to the period of colonialism, because colonial projects were often defended on the grounds that the colonizing power had superior knowledge and culture and was going to generously bring that to the various cultures that it was colonizing. And a very appealing way of resisting that is to say, look, there is no such thing as superior knowledge or superior culture. Everybody has their own culture and they're equally valid. So I think the role that this can play in what is a very justified resistance to being dominated or colonized by a more powerful entity explains part of its appeal, and somehow that got fused with the perception of a lot of people within the academy that the most advanced philosophical thought of their time, in fact, defended this on a theoretical plane.
Paul, I think that's a very powerful analysis you've just given us. And there is this thing that we seem to have learned from that some people take to be one of the lessons of the 21st century, that people who believe things with absolute conviction, like the Nazis, the communists, they just wreak havoc over the rest of us, because it justifies all sorts of imperial projects and all that sort of stuff. And so a kind of humility and tolerance seems to be the only way forward. Do you think there's nothing to that idea?
No, I do. But it's that I think you can distinguish having a sense of your own fallibility, not being overly confident in the truth of what you believe, from relativism, of course. And I think this came up in, I believe it was John's remarks in the preamble, where he said, you know, you mustn't confuse tolerance with relativism. There are very good moral arguments to be made for why, even if you did have a superior knowledge and a superior culture, you shouldn't be imposing it on other people.
So, Paul, we're gonna,
you don't need to go relative in order to make that point.
That's a nice and subtle distinction that we'll have to explore in some depth as we continue. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking, is it all just relative? Our guest is Paul Boghossian from New York University.
In our next segment, we'll dig into the arguments for and against relativism. Can a relativist present a coherent doctrine? Could truth really be relevant to a point of view? Are disagreements between different moral systems or different points of view really just irresolvable?
Relativism, disagreement, and reason, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Do what you want to do. Live and let live. Is it all just relative? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. Are you a moral relativist or a moral absolutist? What do you relativists out there do when confronted with morally repugnant practices like infanticide? You just shrug your shoulders and walk away? Or you try to persuade or force the other to adopt your point of view? But on what grounds? And what about you absolutist out there? What makes you so cocksure that there is an absolute right or wrong of the matter, an absolute truth? And how would you actually recognize an absolute truth if it hit you over the head?
Our guest is Paul Boghossian from NYU, author of Fear of Knowledge, Against Relativism and Constructivism.
So, Paul, your book is Against Relativism and Constructivism. I want to distinguish two different claims about relativism that philosophers sometimes make. There's a claim that many make that it's false, and then there's a very much stronger claim that it's actually incoherent, that you can't even coherently state relativism, at least in certain domains. Which of those do you believe, and why?
Well, the word relativism has been applied to a lot of different positions, and I won't try to list them all. But there are some views to which it's been applied, and especially in certain domains, where I think the result is incoherent, but in other cases where it's not incoherent, but it does look like it's
so incoherent. What's a domain in which you think relativism is just incoherent?
Well, it's not so much a domain in which it's incoherent, but a certain way of running the view in a certain domain. So, for instance, a lot of people say the following kind of thing. Moral judgments are not just true or false. Absolutely, they're relative to a moral code. And then when you look at what they mean by a moral code, it turns out that these are just very general kinds of moral claim, and that is an unstable position because you then have to ask, well, what's the status of the propositions that make up the moral code, and why is it that you prefer one of them to others, and so on and so forth. So it's that there are certain ways of formulating the view that dissolve into incoherence.
Well, let's go back to our roving philosophical reporter and this young lady that threw her newborn child off the roof. Most of us would regard that as wrong. And yet, within America, some people would say, well, abortion up to, you know, the last stages in a case like that young lady's where she'd been raped is okay, but infanticide is wrong. And others would say, no, abortion isn't okay after the first trimester. And then others would say abortion isn't ever right. Now, we've got those disagreements. And, you know, it seems to me, well, it's I don't know if it seems to me, but anyway, it seems to many people, coherent thing to say is, well, you know, if you really deeply believe it's wrong, then you shouldn't do it. If you draw the line somewhere else, then you shouldn't, you should be true to your own instincts. But there is no really universal absolute truth. I mean, what do you say to such people?
So in that case, you're actually looking at the different codes, some of which say you're allowed to do this under these conditions, and others of which say that you're not allowed to do it under other conditions. And the question is, what if somebody were to say, look, they're both valid, right? The thing is, it's very hard off the bat to make sense of that when you've got a proposition or you've got a claim that looks like it's truth evaluable.
Wait a minute. Slow down, Paul.
Okay.
Why would somebody say they're both valid? What they'll say is one's valid for you and the other's valid for me. Valid, just valid full stop. There's none of them are valid full stop. They're just valid for this culture or valid for that culture.
It's wrong for the Catholic to have an abortion. But maybe not for the secularist. It's wrong for the American to throw the kid off the balcony.
Sure.
But maybe not for the African.
So yeah, I don't know about both valid. I don't know about both valid. It's valid over here or valid over there.
Right. So another way of putting that is to say, look, there isn't such a thing as mere validity. There is valid relative to, and then we have to say what that thing is to which it's relative to. So you might think it's instinct or what you find natural and so on and so forth. Now, let me just say, look, even the absolutist has to agree that all kinds of statements are relative in that way. Okay, so take the question, suppose you've got somebody who's broken down on the side of the road. Should you stop and help them or should you just drive on? Well, it depends. And that's what any realist or universalist will tell you. If it's really cold, the person's going to perish, you have nothing better to do, you should stop. If, on the other hand, it's a sunny day, there are lots of friendly people around, you have a medical emergency that you have to attend to, you may drive on by. So that kind of dependence on circumstance is something that any universalist will, of course, allow and acknowledge, and the norms would have to reflect that. Then the question is it plausible, given that we're now talking about what kinds of things moral judgments can depend on, is it plausible to say, well, it really just depends on how you feel? You know, whether it's okay to throw the baby off the roof just depends on whether you find that acceptable. And that just seems like a very implausible kind of dependence.
I grant you that seems like a very odd kind of dependence, but it doesn't have to be that shallow. I mean, think of, you know, complex ways of life that sustain a community. And within this complex way of life that sustains this community, over here, our complex way of life does not permit abortion. And over here, it does. And who is to say, where could absolute facts about etiquette come from? Where could absolute facts about whether abortion is permissible come from? There was an old view, you know, God just commands, right? And then, but once you give up on that, then you have this question, what could ground this? Well, we've got a complex way of life which supports abortion and a woman's right as preeminent, and we've got a complex way of life which doesn't support that. It's not just a matter of feeling.
No, but what I would say to you is that what you're now giving expression to is the endorsement of a certain kind of universal normative claim as opposed to another. What you're saying is, look, if a certain practice were sufficiently well embedded into a complex and coherent form of life that sustains all kinds of other good things, we could very well say that that practice is justified or correct relative to those circumstances, just like we would say about driving on by if the circumstances were as I described them. But what you're doing there, you're not really saying where do absolute moral facts come from. You're in fact endorsing one of them. It's just that you're saying those absolute facts tend to have a certain shape. They take into account all kinds of other things beyond the act specifically at issue. No one can disagree with that.
So let me suggest a model, which from reading your book I know you won't accept, but so time zones. Now, Ken and I are in the Pacific time zone, and we can perfectly coherently have a disagreement about whether it's 29 after the hour, as my watch says, or 30 minutes after the hour, as his watch says. But you, I think, are over in Europe, England maybe?
That's correct.
And so you can't, it wouldn't be coherent for us to have a disagreement with you, right? So we say, what time it is relative to the time zone you're in. Of course, there is an overarching absolute truth, which is to say it's this time in this time zone at the same time it's that time in that o'clock in that time zone. Isn't morality like that? You know, relative to different cultures, different things are right, but it's an absolute truth that, given the culture, things are wrong. How's that for a compromise?
That's very nice, and I hope you didn't read my book as denying that there are time zones. But,
no, I don't think meant that. No. He meant you couldn't treat more relativism and morality.
Though maybe it follows from my views that there are no time zones. But I think the crucial thing is that time zone isn't the kind of thing that can be itself assessed as either correct or incorrect. Okay, it's a parameter to which you relativize, but it itself, you just have to specify it, and then we can talk about what's true in that time zone. But in the case of moral frameworks, that's not like that, because now you're relativizing to the very kind of thing that's at issue. If you can find a way of relativizing not to a moral framework, but rather to a set of circumstances, then the kind of game that's being played is to ask, well, which morality is true? Is it a morality that says, you know, if the person is safe and you have a medical emergency, then you're allowed to drive on by? Or is it the kind of morality that says, no, under all conditions, you should stop and help the person?
So look, here, I want to object something else here. Yeah. I have to confess up, I have very strong relativist tendencies, so I'm going to be fighting back with you here, Paul. Well, look, I don't think that moral systems are in the business of being true or false. They're in the business of being ours or not ours. If it's mine, then a moral system directs me to be a certain way. If it's yours, it directs you to be a certain way. Your moral system can't direct me. Your moral system can direct your attitude toward me, but that's your moral system. Sure, it can direct your attitude toward me. Moral systems aren't true or false. They're just ours or not ours. What do you think about that thought?
Well, I mean, if you take that line, it looks as though there can't really be moral disagreement, because moral, unless you tell me how to think about disagreement in a kind of non-truthy way. But we tend to think usually, yeah, that there are two people on the opposite sides. This person says infanticide under these conditions is okay, and the other person says not. So how should we think about disagreement
we should think of it like this. We should think that moral disagreements are disagreements in what might be called attitude, not disagreement over fact, but disagreements in our attitudes. I approve of infanticide? I don't, but suppose I did. I approve of infanticide? You disapprove of infanticide. Your disapproval drives you in a certain way, because that's one of the things attitudes do, is drive us to behave and criticize. My attitude drives me to resist your. I mean, so our disagreements aren't disagreements over some realm of transcendental fact. They're disagreements over in our attitudes. What's wrong with that?
Well, nothing much may be wrong with that per se, that is, except for the fact that that it seems descriptively inadequate to the kinds of views that we have. That is, when I see something that I find morally abhorrent, I don't just think, I have an aesthetic dislike for that, or I'm against it. I think that is abhorrent. When I think about mass murder, I don't just think, gee, I'm not into that.
We've got some emails here, quite a few actually. So we have one from Dan, and he says, look, torture is wrong. It's heartbreaking at a visceral level to most sensitive human beings, but it's simply another fact. That's just another fact in a network of fact. There's no transcendent substances called rightness and wrongness. We have another related email, which has to do with can a religious person be a relativist, or do they, like the Pope, have to be an absolutist? And finally, Gregory Slater reminds us wisely, in my opinion, that we shouldn't just focus on South Americans and throw their babies off of buildings and Hitler. We should also note that there's something wrong with the moral absolutist who agrees with unprovoked attacks on societies that have not attacked us, and he gives a number of examples.
So, Paul, respond to anything that you want in those emails.
You know, the point about the writer put it is that there are no substances called right and wrong. It's a very interesting way of putting it, because I think one of the things that makes people leery about moral absolutism or universalism is they think, look, it's just not moral facts. If there were any, would just be very strange kinds of things.
Queer, as Mackie called them.
Queer, as Mackie says, though that might be misunderstood. they're not on a par with the physical world. Here is a chair. It sits here. I'm sitting in front of the desk. Those are real facts. Now, where are these facts about rightness or wrongness? They're not written on the surfaces of things, and I can't see them with my eyes, and so on and so forth. And I think that's a very, very powerful impulse that we have when we first think about this. And the only cure for it is to remember that we talk about lots and lots of things about which we could not but help think that there are facts which aren't in the same way tangible in the way that these physical facts are. So arithmetical facts and logical facts and perhaps aesthetic facts, although that's probably as problematic as the moral case. I think that's one thing that philosophers can be helpful with, and that is to try to give a more general way of thinking about truth and objective truth in a way that won't land you in trouble trying to figure out where the rightness and wrongness of things inhere.
Now, the fellow who made that remark, Dan, gave us a follow-up email. It says, but what is universal for the most part is human psychology. So there are rules that are constant if you want to create happiness and social peace. So Dan is sitting over there discovering utilitarianism and the whole history of ethics, and good for Dan.
Paul, you want to respond to what John said just briefly, quickly?
Well, just that, the normative, I think, it will always go beyond the descriptive. So the universals of psychology by themselves won't fix what's right and what's wrong.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking, is it all just relative, with Paul Boghossian from New York University. He's the author of the very fine book, Fear of Knowledge, Against Relativism and Constructivism.
In our final segment, we'll look at the widespread fear of relativism. What exactly is it about relativism that makes it such an object of fear and loathing by people like the Pope and various commentators on radio and TV? Could we or could we not live in a world governed by relativism?
Deconstructing the fear of relativism when Philosophy Talk continues.
Different strokes for different folks. I mean, for crying out loud, that was a TV show, wasn't it? I mean, what could possibly be wrong with that? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and today we're asking the question, is it all just relative? Our guest is Paul Boghossian, author of Fear of Knowledge, Against Relativism and Constructivism. And we've got a caller on the line now, Charles in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charles.
Hi, thank you. My question is this. If a morality is either right or wrong, but it also is a fact that people do disagree, then how do you decide who's right or wrong? And are you saying that it is actually possible to do that? Because if it is not possible to do that, then in effect, we do have relativism.
Good question, Charles. Thanks for the question. Charles is asking about the accessibility, the epistemic accessibility, as we philosophers like to call it, of an absolute moral truth. What do you got to say about that, Paul?
Well, it was a terrific question and a wonderful kind of transition from what we philosophers like to call a metaphysical question to an epistemological question. And along with the observation that if we can't solve the issue of how we know which of two disputants is correct, then, as he said, well, don't we have a relativism there anyway, because it's a relativism now at the level of who's entitled to say that they know, if you like. That's roughly the kind of line of thinking. But the first thing to say about this is that there really is a big difference between the so-called metaphysical issue, is there a right or wrong, and the question of how do we know who's right and wrong. And there's even a third thing, which is how do you resolve a dispute between two people? And these three things do not line up at all. Even the last two things don't line up, because although there may be a fact of the matter and you may know it, you may have very good evidence and justification for believing something about this, you may encounter somebody who is starting at a far enough place from you that you can never bring them around by rational means. I think we see that not just in the moral domain, but we can see that even in the factual domain. If somebody has very, very, very different assumptions from where you are, imagine just using a time machine and trying to talk to a pre-Aristotelian Greek about whether the earth is round or flat, you may not be able to persuade them given the resources that are available to them and that you may be able to get them to comprehend. So I think, you know, a lot of people are moved to relativism precisely by the intractability of a deep-seated moral disagreement. But it would be a mistake to move very quickly from that to, therefore, there is no fact of the matter. There may as well be no fact of the matter.
I agree that it would be a mistake to move very quickly, but there is a challenge in there. The absolute moral truth, if there is one, I mean, it has to be epistemically accessible. That's a constraint on our rationally believing that there is such a thing, that there is a way that we could conceive of ourselves knowing it, don't you think?
Well, I think, you see, look, there are two things.
At least an ideal inquirer with all kinds of time and no limits in his reasoning.
That's fair. Look, you could become convinced on very general grounds of the kind that I might try to give you that there have to be some normative truths. Okay. And then, so you've established that there are some and that you've somehow gotten to know what they are. Now the question is, you know, whenever you come across a disagreement, are you always able to resolve it by rational means? And the answer to that may well be no.
I agree about
that. For various reasons.
We have a very thoughtful email from Sean Pyle, who's a University of Minnesota Morris philosophy major. And hi, Sean. Thanks for writing. I've been to the University of Minnesota Morris, and I hope the walleye are still biting in the local lake. He makes this very interesting point. The relativist may think that relativism leads to toleration, to being tolerant. But how can the relativist claim that? The relativist can't claim that it's a universal truth, that it's good to be tolerant. So really the universalist is in much better shape to give a defense of tolerance, the sort of thing the relativist claims to be doing. Now, I think that's the kind of point that our Pope might think was a really good one, leading us back to what we're going to discuss a little bit in this part of the arc.
What do you think about that, Paul?
Well, you know, I made a similar point in the book, actually, in the epilogue, that I think Sean is entirely right that what happens is that people are attracted to relativism by thinking that it makes them anti-authoritarian and more tolerant of disagreement and so forth. But on the other hand, they want to criticize certain people. We all do. We all have very strong views about what things are incorrect and should not be done. And the kind of leveling that relativism gives you wipes the ground out from under your feet when you try to do that.
But see, this
makes you employ double standards.
This I think, is people often criticize relativism for it leading to a vapid tolerance. Right? You have to tolerate a wishy-washy, you know, everything is equally valid, and so you have no grounds. I just don't see that. I've written some stuff about this. I'm writing a big book about it. I distinguish between tolerant relativism and intolerant relativism. I don't see why relativism ipso facto entails this vapid tolerance. I can criticize from my moral point of view other moral stances, even if the other doesn't accept my criticism. It can empower me, my moral point. Why can't my moral point of view license me, just because it's mine, in criticizing the other? Why can't that be?
Sure. You know, look, I think these are really, really good questions. The part of what this goes to the heart of is how we're thinking about relativism. So if you start out thinking that it means equal validity, then obviously you end up with the problem we're discussing, and it makes intolerant relativism seem like an oxymoron. Now the question is, how are we thinking about relativism in such a way that it can be intolerant? What kind of privilege are we according our own view from which we are going to criticize the actions of people who think there is nothing wrong with what they're doing relative to their own perspective, without lapsing into a kind of covert universalism?
Well, you might think that a criticism can't be justifiably addressed to the other unless that other is in a position to rationally accept that criticism. But I don't see why you should think that. I mean, you can legitimately address a criticism to another even if they have standards that prohibit them from accepting it. And if they won't accept their criticism, like the slaveholders might not have accepted the criticisms of the abolitionists, what's wrong with your moral framework licensing you, even if they won't accept the license, to abolish slavery by force? That's how the world
Absolutely.
Works.
Absolutely. Now, so here's the thing. That's exactly what the absolutist or the universalist thinks. Now, the question is, you've described such a view and you've labeled it relativism. How do we tell the difference between universalism and relativism in your sense?
Well, here's the thing. There is no transcendent moral authority that will settle these disputes. Nietzsche said, we used to think of morality as a hallowed place of peace where all disputes came to an end. And he said in the gay science, his great discovery was, there is no hallowed place of peace. There is no place where we can take a rest from ceaseless argument, ceaseless pushing and shoving against each other's moral rights. That's just a fact of human life. It's just our predicament. It's not escapable.
But look, Ken, let's go back to our original example. You like single malt whiskey. I like Irish whiskey. Some people love Pabst Blue Ribbon. From your point of view, I can't see why your argument doesn't work as well there. You know, you just think, well, maybe from their point of view, single malt Scotch whiskey isn't as good as Irish whiskey, but I'm going to enforce my point of view, particularly if there's only so much stuff we can import.
Well, you could make that run, but here's the thing. We endorse some norms as what I call traveling. We try to make them travel, and some we say are merely local. And the ones that feel like moral norms are the ones we try to enforce even on a resisting world. And that's just how we're designed, to try to enforce norms even on a resisting world. And when we come to the face of resistance, we try to stop argument by saying, it's true, god darn it. I know the absolute truth, god darn it. But that's just an illusion. Our illusion that comes with our trying to enforce norms of our own endorsing on a resisting world.
So, Paul, does Ken sound like a closet absolutist to you?
You know, he's got both features going. He's got some universal features and some relativistic features. I think that it's going to be very hard to distinguish between the position he's describing and a universalist view. The Nietzschean thing about ceaseless argument, you know, that could easily be embraced by a universalist who thinks that getting to know the moral facts and resolving moral disagreements is a very, very tough business, and there is nothing short of the kind of ceaseless normative argumentation that we engage in that's going to settle moral issues for us.
We got John in San Francisco. Sorry, Bud. Do you want to finish that?
Sorry, Ken. Go right ahead.
We've got John in San Francisco on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Oh, thank you. I was going to ask, why do we have to have separate camps of absolutism and relativism? Why can't things be relatively absolute and absolutely relative as they are in the real world? For example, your example of the motorist stranded on the road, would I stop to help him? Well, 30 years ago, I might have, you know. The world was a different place. Today, a lot of people will pretend to be broken down on the road. You stop and help them, and they rob you. So why wouldn't I? I mean, the advice of most authorities is, in such circumstances, notify an authoritative figure as quick as possible. If I have a cell phone, I'll call the state police or whoever is in charge of the road, and then it's out of my hands, and nobody is going to get robbed. Things in the real world depend on numerous factors other than the cut and dry, relative or absolute. I guess that's all I had to say.
So that's a lot there. What do you want to say in response, Paul?
That's another lovely example. The pithy response is just to say, look, what's the difference between the 30s and now is that the facts have changed, not the norms. And of course, the norms are sensitive to what the facts are, even on a realist or absolutist view. So there's no real challenge there to the universalist, who is perfectly willing to allow that if it's dangerous for you to stop, then you ought not to stop and call the authorities instead. And if, unfortunately, the facts have changed so that now it's dangerous for us to stop, then the normative...
I suppose, though, that he's thinking that the constellation of facts can change the norms it's reasonable for us to adopt. I mean, think of norms as things, you know, we have a choice, in at least in some norms, at least even your absolutists will think that some norms are optional and we can adopt them for pragmatic reasons. And maybe, you know, a norm of helping strangers makes sense when strangers don't mostly kill you, right? But a norm of helping strangers makes no sense when they mostly might. What do you think about that?
I mean, for the kind of contingencies
of the norms that ought to govern us.
Well, I mean, for an unreconstructed objectivist like me, I don't really know how to make sense of the norms changing. I think all we could really mean is that there are some very general normative things that tell you what norms to adopt or rules of thumb to adopt and so forth and so on. And, you know, very generally, I don't think that example poses a challenge to that picture, because all it's saying is, you know, it used to be that it was perfectly safe to stop, but now it's not.
So you might say that the absolutist or the universalist isn't someone who says everything is universal or absolute. They can recognize a lot of relativity. They're just denying that everything is relative, and in particular that everything in the realm of morals and truth is ultimately relative.
One could put it that way, but I think it would be a slightly misleading way of putting it, because the crucial thing to stress is that any universalist thinks that what you ought to do, what's right, what's wrong, depends on the circumstances. Nobody for a minute thought otherwise. So if you want, you can call this dependence on the circumstances as a form of relativism, but I think that's a misleading way of putting it.
Paul, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been an absolutely scintillating conversation.
Thank you so much.
Our guest has been Paul Boghossian, professor of philosophy at New York University, author of Fear of Knowledge, Against Relativism and Constructivism. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we turn to the relatively speedy Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, some say the war on science began with Thomas Kuhn, who wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in 1962. claiming that science advances by fits and starts. As an unfortunate side effect of the book's publication, the words paradigm shift have popped up in student essays ever since. That book was embraced by Lit Crit Humanities postmodern arty types, who, in the paradigm shift of the 60s, folded it into the whatever's right, if it feels good, do it, everything is true, nothing is true, spirit of the times. Science is just culture-driven, man. Nothing is real. In one postmodern feminist critique of science, the claim was made that Einstein's famous E equals MC squared was sexist because it privileged the speed of light over other speeds. Of course, there is a cultural element to science. Lysenkoism comes to mind, the official biology of the Soviet Union. Biological characteristics are inherited. The revolution is occurring on a molecular level. This was a reaction to genetics, which commies declared a bourgeois pseudoscience in 1948. Geneticists were fired, some imprisoned. Over in Nazi Germany, Einstein's theories were rejected as Jewish science. Today in America, there is a sizable animus to the concept of global warming as a liberal and socialist plot to control energy resources. And there's always been a popular image of scientists as pointy-headed, amoral types who'd as soon create a monster as destroy the world. On the other hand, we also love science and misuse its terms every day. If we say somebody has evolved, for example, we're not talking about ape-like ancestors, but a higher emotional and spiritual plane. When we say, I'm just hardwired that way, we don't mean we are devices containing elements that can't be altered, exactly. We mean, that's the way I roll. Concepts like quantum theory, chaos theory, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, hermeneutics, and anomaly are tossed around in conflict classes and New Age seminars as though we actually know what we're talking about. We see things like crime as a cancer in the society, even though, you know, crime is nothing like cancer. When something gets looked at a lot on the internet, we say it's gone viral. In science, a virus is a small infectious agent that replicates inside the living cells of organisms. Okay, that's about right. The point is, the war on science can only end when two sides come together. And there is hope. If you ever saw the deeply silly documentary, What the Bleep Do We Know?, you might remember a man named John Hagelin. He's a transcendental meditator who seeks to prove that the mental unity in a meditative state is the subjective experience of the unity of existence revealed by unified field theory. He is a particle physicist, but he was also named Raja of Invincible America by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. One man's pseudoscience is another man's path to enlightenment. One man's mathematical proof is another man's woo-woo. It's all relative, man. Chill. Scientists, if you cannot beat the other side, join them. After all, we are all one. Or whatever. I gotta go.
The 60-Second Philosopher is brought to you in part by the EPGY Online High School at Stanford University.
Learn more at epgy.stanford.edu/online.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leah Weiss is our webmaster.
And special thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Dave Millar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Ryssdal.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how are you, man?
I'm great. Thanks, Kai. I've been thinking about you, actually, lately.
Really?
I've been reminiscing. I was thinking about the very first radio piece that you and I did together back at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
You remember? Let me take you back here,
all right.
Kai.
So here we are, and this is great, and I'm having a good time, but the game doesn't start for like an hour and a half. Why are we at batting practice?
So you remember that, Kai, yes?
I do, yes.
You remember we were watching batting practice, and we saw A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, hitting all those massive home runs into the bleachers? You
shocking
remember that?
Yeah. Now, huh?
Okay. Well, Kai, it's funny you remember that, because, in fact, it did not happen.
I was there.
We did not see A-Rod. We were there. We did not see A-Rod hit any home runs. But you did just beautifully illustrate the topic of our conversation today, which is false memory. Thank you very much for playing.
Anytime. I'm glad to help. Please continue.
Now, I got to thinking about this topic during all the Roundup interviews that Hillary Clinton has been doing recently, reminiscing about, you know, she's had a very eventful term as Secretary of State. And I was reminded of another Hillary Clinton reminiscence that turned out to be a bit off. Kai, I'm interested to know if you remember this piece of tape.
I remember landing under sniper fire.
Oh, yeah.
There was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles. To get to our base.
Yeah, and the thing was, there was no sniper fire, right?
That's exactly right. Hillary Clinton later said that she misspoke or maybe misremembered. So to speak about misremembering, here is Elizabeth Loftus.
Okay.
What I love about this example is that it shows you that all that education, all that experience, all those IQ points, that Yale Law School degree, it doesn't protect you from having a false memory.
So, Kai, Loftus is a psych professor at UC Irvine. She's a leading scholar in memory generally and false memory in particular. So recently, she and a couple of colleagues, along with Slate, the online magazine completed a study. And this study was huge, 5,000 participants. And they looked into how well we people generally remember political events, okay?
Right.
So what they would do is the researchers would show people photographs of various political events, but the gimmick was that each participant would see four photographs, three of them real, and then one that was doctored, okay? Hmm. So for instance, George Bush hanging out at his ranch with his buddy Roger Clemens during Hurricane Katrina, which did not happen.
No.
Or they'd see a picture of Barack Obama in a nice friendly handshake with President Ahmadinejad of Iran, which also never happened.
Yep.
But Kai, here's the amazing thing. About half the participants in this study said that they did remember the thing that never happened. Okay, here's Elizabeth Loftus again.
Many individuals wrote in details that expanded upon just the claim. I remember seeing this photograph. I remember seeing this photograph of President Obama shaking the hand of the president of Iran. And they may even tell you something about the feelings they remember having at the time they saw that photograph for the first time. But of course, they couldn't have ever seen it before because it was completely made up with Photoshop.
That's crazy, man.
It is crazy. Honestly, it gets crazier. And the crazier part speaks to how partisan we are, our country. And I'm not just talking about the politicians, but the rest of us, too. So what Loftus and her colleagues did, they did a follow-up study, and they found that Democrats and Republicans remembered different fake events very differently, which is to say, a Democratic voter was much more likely to think that the picture of Bush and Roger Clemens was real. And similarly, or, you know, conversely, a Republican was more likely to believe that Obama had really shaken hands with Ahmadinejad.
And one wonders why Washington is in the state it is in, right?
It's depressing. I mean, you could say that we do a lot of it on purpose, but you could also argue based on this that maybe a lot of it is just the way we're hardwired to root for our teams. I will tell you this.
Yeah.
The research also suggests that there may be a way to improve, however, this gridlock in Washington, as long as you're willing to engage in a little bit of trickery. What I'm thinking, Kai, is this.
Washington never.
How about this? Nice doctored photograph. You and I could put this together of President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner shooting skeet together, I'm thinking.
we totally could.
Or how about the two of them at a ball game in Yankee Stadium, just like you and I
just
were
like
there,
you
although,
and me,
you know,
man.
The more I think about it, the less sure I am that you and I were actually ever at Yankee Stadium at all.
I was there, dude. I was there. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. That was pretty cool.
Thanks, Guy. Thanks for having me. Hey, podcast listeners. My Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt has studied crime for years, including gun control, which is why he thinks most of the new gun legislation won't do much of anything.
If your goal is to limit the amount of damage done by guns, then given the fact that guns are a durable good that will work for 50 or 100 years, you can't have policies that only affect new guns. If you have a stock of 300 million guns, it doesn't really matter what you do with the new guns if you don't do anything with the guns that are already out there.
On the next Freakonomics Radio, how to talk about guns.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Inviting you into my house for the mix every Thursday night from 9 to midnight right here on WHFR.FM. For over 8 years, I've been bringing you the best in techno, trance, house, and dance. Now spun live every week by local Detroit DJs. Experience the longest-running local electronic mix show this and every Thursday night right here on WHFR.
It takes 12 years to create a graduate. It takes about the same time to create a dropout. And at the end of the day, the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be you. So United Way is asking you to make a pledge. Tutor a child who needs help. Mentor a kid who needs someone on their side. Volunteer to read to children. Because when a child advances, we all advance. Be a reader, tutor, or mentor. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge now at liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
You ready?
Yes, sir!
We are Pack 547.
We are Pack 547!
From Redford, Michigan.
From Redford, Michigan!
We are proud of our city.
We are proud!